Most reggae stories center on bass lines, rebellion, or roots. But what if the most revolutionary sound came from a child's toy played like a spiritual weapon? Augustus Pablo transformed a humble melodica into a sacred instrument of dub, conjuring eerie, meditative melodies that haunted the airwaves like a Rastafarian prayer. While the world celebrated Marley's lyrics or Tubby's engineering, Pablo's sound was whispering another truth, one steeped in mysticism, Eastern philosophy, and ghetto suffering. Born Horace Swaby, he never fit the mold of the star. He was quiet, frail-looking, deeply spiritual, yet his productions helped define the soul of an entire genre. So why is his name so often sidelined? Why has the melodica, once ridiculed as a toy, become the voice of dub's deepest emotions? This isn't just music history, it's a story of spiritual resistance, of sonic prophecy, and of a man who refused to speak loudly, but was heard across generations. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1, Mystic Youth, Birth of a Dub Prophet. In a Kingston neighborhood brushed by salt winds and unrest, a quiet boy wandered through sound like others wandered through school books. His name was Horace Swaby, but no one knew yet that he would become Augustus Pablo, the mystic sound man who would change dub forever. At first glance, he was unremarkable, slim, soft-spoken, contemplative. But Horace saw the world through echo chambers and bass lines. Where others heard static, he heard messages. Where others saw toys, he saw instruments of liberation. He was born on June 21st, 1954, in the middle-class Havendale area of Kingston, a place tucked between the struggling downtown and the quiet uptown hills. His family wasn't wealthy, but they weren't poor either. They encouraged education and spirituality, especially through his devout Christian mother. Piano lessons were part of his early childhood, and his musical ear developed quickly. But Kingston in the late 60s was a city on edge, roiling with political violence, street battles, and the birth of new sound systems that turned sidewalks into sonic battlefields. Horace found himself drawn more to the hypnotic pull of these emerging soundscapes than to traditional schooling. Skipping classes, he wandered into music shops and hung out at record stalls on Orange Street, the same strip that would later give birth to some of reggae's greatest hits. One day, as the story goes, he walked into Herman Chin Loy's Aquarius Records store and found a dusty melodica tucked between shelves. It was meant to be a toy, a child's training keyboard with a plastic mouthpiece. But when Horace lifted it to his lips and played, something uncanny emerged. Not a toy's sound, but a tone that felt ancient, ghostly, and deeply moving. Chin Loy, a producer and studio operator, immediately took notice. Horace was no ordinary kid. He had a sensitivity to tone and timing that rivaled seasoned musicians. His notes lingered in the air like incense smoke, not flashy, but undeniably powerful. Chin Loy gave him a chance to record, and in 1971, Augustus Pablo was born. The name Augustus Pablo wasn't originally Horace's. It was a pseudonym used by Chin Loy for various instrumental releases. But when Horace began using it consistently, it stuck. It fit the mystique. Augustus, imperial, ancient. Pablo, vaguely exotic. Combined, it sounded like a prophet from another time. What Horace began crafting under that name wasn't just instrumental reggae. It was something slower, deeper, an invocation rather than entertainment. And it was grounded in spiritual seeking. By his late teens, Horace had fully embraced the Rastafari faith. But unlike many of his peers, who focused their Rasta identity around militant lyrics and dread proclamations, Pablo internalized the faith. It showed not through chance, but through tone. His use of the melodica became a form of Nyabingi meditation, the soft exhale of a horn over a thunderous, steady rhythm. The notes were stretched, bent, reverbed, and looped until they dissolved into mysticism. Then came his connection with Clive Chin, the son of legendary Randy's record store owner Vincent Chin, and King Tubby, the sonic scientist, redefining music by subtracting elements instead of adding them. This trifecta, Pablo, Chin, and Tubby, would shape dub reggae's Holy Trinity. Pablo's early productions, like Java and East of the River Nile, didn't just introduce a new voice to reggae. They introduced a new feeling, meditative yet tense, haunted yet peaceful. They whispered of deserts and dreadlocks, temples and shanty towns. They used silence as power, and they began to redefine the very structure of reggae. But Pablo's genius didn't fit easily into the commercial mold. Reggae in the early 70s was still emerging, and most producers wanted vocals, charisma, and street appeal. Pablo brought none of that. He avoided the spotlight. He barely spoke in interviews. He didn't dance. He didn't shout. He played and then vanished. Yet behind closed studio doors, he was building a legacy that would outlast many of his flashier peers. The melodica became his weapon of choice, not because it was trendy, but because it allowed for breath. Pablo's use of the instrument was so intimate that listeners often described it as singing without words. You could hear longing, faith, sorrow, and wisdom, all from a simple mouthpiece and plastic keys. His recordings also defied geography. While most reggae was rooted in Kingston, Pablo's early albums evoked the spiritual vastness of other worlds. The Far East, in his track titles, wasn't just style, it was direction. He tapped into themes of Eastern mysticism, meditative trance, and ancestral calling, blending them with gritty roots rhythms. His music sounded like the future seen through ancient eyes. This chapter of Pablo's life, from teenager to studio visionary, is filled with paradox. A man of few words who expressed so much. A producer who avoided the spotlight but shaped a genre. A musician who chose a toy instrument and transformed it into dub's spiritual soul. And yet, despite these contributions, major labels barely touched him. He didn't look or sound like the reggae hero they could sell. He didn't give the press sound bites. He didn't play by rules. But that was the point. Pablo wasn't trying to entertain. He was trying to tune the world into another frequency, one of healing, meditation, resistance, and stillness in a violent world. By the mid-1970s, his influence was unmistakable in the underground. A quiet revolution was underway. Sound systems began playing his dubs at 3 a.m., when the crowd was thin and the ganja smoke heavy. That's when Pablo's rhythms hit hardest. Not when you danced, but when you closed your eyes and listened. His Rockers International label, founded in 1974, became both a record store and a sanctuary for these ghostly vibrations. In many ways, Pablo's early life and first rise were a rebellion in slow motion. Where others raged against Babylon with fire, he floated above it in fog. Where the world screamed, he whispered, and somehow, you heard it louder than ever. Chapter 2, The Invisible Architect of Dub. In the mid-1970s, Augustus Pablo stood at the crossroads of obscurity and legend and chose the road cloaked in fog. He wasn't chasing charts or fame. He was building a temple of sound, brick by invisible brick. And while others climbed stages, Pablo carved silence into rhythm and echo. He was no longer just a performer. He had become a high priest of dub. The establishment didn't quite know what to do with him. Reggae was exploding, pushed forward by charismatic frontmen like Bob Marley and Peter Tosh. Island Records and major international labels were hungry for revolutionaries with charm, artists who could electrify crowds and look good on posters. Pablo didn't fit the mold. He didn't tour aggressively. He didn't give speeches. His interviews were sparse, and when he did speak, it was in quiet, meditative riddles. But in the sound system underground, in the streets of Kingston, London, Tokyo, and later New York, his influence was seismic. Pablo's Rockers International label wasn't just a studio, it was a sanctum. Inside its modest walls on Orange Street, he crafted rhythms that pulsed like heartbeats and drifted like incense. He produced for emerging artists like Hugh Mundell, Jacob Miller, and Junior Delgado, voices of the ghetto who shared Pablo's vision of spiritual struggle and sonic healing. One of his most profound collaborations was with a teenage Hugh Mundell. Barely 16 years old, Mundell carried a voice that sounded both ancient and revolutionary. In 1978, they released Africa Must Be Free by 1983, an album produced entirely by Pablo. It wasn't just an album, it was a prophecy in wax. Mundell's righteous lyrics danced over Pablo's haunting instrumentals, painting visions of repatriation, Black Consciousness, and Pan-African Pride. The record became a cornerstone of roots reggae and one of the genre's most spiritually potent works. And yet, no Grammy nominations, no global campaigns, no mainstream praise, just whispers, just echoes, just disciples. While Marley and Island Records were polishing reggae for global consumption, Pablo was deep in the roots, preserving its spiritual core. He didn't simplify the message, he made it deeper. Dub wasn't a genre to him, it was a ritual. The studio was his temple, the delay pedal, his sensor, the mixing board, his altar, his landmark collaboration with King Tubby, King Tubby Meets Rockers. Uptown stands today as one of the most influential dub albums of all time. Released in 1976, it was a sonic duel between two visionaries. Pablo's melodic meditations collided with Tubby's cavernous reverb and delay. What emerged was less an album and more a soundscape, slow, dark, pulsing, divine. But even within the Jamaican music community, Pablo was something of an enigma. He didn't socialize much. He wasn't seen at big music parties or political rallies. Some said he was aloof. Others said he was simply on another level of consciousness. And that wasn't far from the truth. Pablo was deeply immersed in Rastafari, but his interpretation was unique. He blended Rasta's African roots with Eastern philosophy, Ethiopian mysticism, and a quiet, monk-like discipline. He didn't preach, he emanated. He lived simply. Ate ital food, spoke softly, meditated often. Even his clothing, loose-fitting, earth-toned robes, mirrored his sound, flowing, unforced, natural. But Jamaica in the late 70s was not a peaceful place for mystics. The country was splintered by political violence. Gangs aligned with opposing parties battled in the streets. Assassinations, arson, and fear gripped Kingston. The same ghettos that birthed reggae were now soaked in blood, and artists weren't safe. Hugh Mundell would be gunned down in 1983. Jacob Miller died in a mysterious car crash in 1980. The air around Rockers International grew thick with paranoia. Pablo, too, would face tragedy. In the 1980s, his health began to decline. He suffered from a rare nerve disorder called myasthenia gravis, a condition that weakens muscles and affects movement. It drained him, physically, limiting his ability to tour or even play for extended periods. While other producers leaned into digital sounds and computerized rhythms, Pablo remained analog, tactile, and spiritual. He rejected the emerging slackness of 80s dancehall, the gun lyrics, the sexual vulgarity, the Americanized posturing. He stayed true to his sound, but staying true came with a cost. By the mid-80s, Pablo's presence faded from the mainstream entirely. Rockers International struggled financially. The vinyl market was collapsing. The industry pivoted toward dancehall and crossover appeal. Pablo was now seen by many as a relic, too quiet, too mystical, too slow. But in other corners of the world, London, Paris, Tokyo, his legend was growing. European sound system crews revered him as a prophet. Japanese collectors paid premium prices for original Rockers pressings. Dub clubs from Berlin to Brooklyn began spinning Pablo's records at 2 a.m., not to hype the crowd, but to cleanse them. His sound had become a form of post-club healing, a kind of audio baptism. And yet, Augustus Pablo never chased that wave. He rarely left Jamaica. He continued producing from his modest studio. He mentored his son, Addis Pablo, guiding him in the same spiritual and sonic tradition. He stayed rooted in the island soil that birthed him, even as the industry passed him by. By the early 90s, dub was undergoing a revival. UK-based acts like Josh Shaka, Mad Professor, and Zion Train began name-checking Pablo as a foundational influence. Hip-hop artists started sampling his tracks. Lo-fi producers and ambient musicians saw in Pablo's work a blueprint for atmospheric minimalism. Without ever leaving his meditative bubble, he had become the invisible architect of several genres. But in Jamaica, recognition was still rare. While other pioneers received national honors and international documentaries, Pablo's story remained half-told, often reduced to melodica guy. The full depth of his contribution, his vision of dub as a spiritual practice, as a cultural balm, as a form of liberation, was still misunderstood. Still, Pablo never seemed bitter. He didn't want the spotlight. He wanted the sound to speak. And it did, louder and farther than any stage ever could. In 1995, Pablo released Valley of a Jehoshaphat, one of his final albums. It was sparse, eerie, majestic. It sounded like a man looking beyond the physical world, and maybe he was. By then, he was sick, weakened, a shadow of his earlier self. But when he played the melodica, it still sounded like sunrise over the Blue Mountains. In 1999, Augustus Pablo died in Kingston at the age of 44. His death was quiet. No parades, no global media frenzy, just echoes. But those echoes still move. Chapter 3, Legacy of a Haunting Sound. Augustus. Pablo never craved applause. He didn't chase headlines or red carpets. And yet today, decades after his death, the sound he conjured from a toy melodica still ripples through the global musical landscape. Not as a nostalgic echo, but as a living, breathing force. You'll hear it in places you'd never expect. In a Brooklyn apartment, a lo-fi producer layers Pablo's melodica samples over dusty vinyl crackle, crafting beats for meditation playlists with millions of streams. In Tokyo, a Roots sound system plays his original vinyls under glowing lanterns as dreadlocked Japanese selectors chant in patois. In Paris, yoga studios and underground clubs spin his dubs during sunrise sets, where dancers close their eyes and sway in silent reverence. And in Kingston, a new generation revisits his rhythms, not as relics, but as scripture. This is Pablo's true legacy, not fame, but frequency, not applause, but resonance. His music wasn't meant to dominate charts. It was meant to linger in your bones, your breath, your blood. After his death in 1999, the silence was deafening for those who truly understood what he'd given. Jamaica barely acknowledged the loss. The government issued no official tribute. There was no state funeral. But among sound system faithful, producers, and underground artists, the mourning was profound. Some likened it to a prophet ascending. Others called it the final echo. But the echoes didn't end. The resurrection of rockers Pablo's son, Addis Pablo, became the torchbearer. Trained under his father's guidance, Addis didn't simply imitate. He expanded. He carried the same meditative spirit, but added his own flavor, experimenting with hip-hop, dubstep, ambient, and world music. His 2014 debut album, In My Father's House, felt like a conversation across time. Pablo speaking through vintage analog warmth, Addis replying with 21st century beats and global collaborations. The Rockers International Record Shop was revived too, partly as a pilgrimage site for fans and partly as an archive of Pablo's unmatched catalog. It became a space where history, music, and mysticism merged. Tourists wandered in, not just to buy records, but to understand a movement. For those who had followed Pablo from the beginning, this rebirth felt like spiritual continuity, like dub itself had reincarnated, the global cult of Pablo. But how did a man who barely toured, who played a toy instrument, who rarely spoke, how did he become a global icon? Because Pablo's sound was universal. His music transcended language. It didn't need verses to move you. It didn't depend on nationalism or genre conventions. It was about tone, space, intention. Where reggae had been associated with protest and fire, Pablo introduced contemplation and stillness. He brought prayer into the mix. And in a digital world drowning in noise, that silence became sacred. In the 2010s and 2020s, Pablo's influence exploded across genres. In lo-fi hip-hop, his melodies became templates for calm, moody instrumental tracks. In ambient music, his dub production style, reverb, delay, minimalism, became foundational. In spiritual and wellness circles, his albums played during meditation, yoga, and breathwork sessions. In film and television, his tracks and their echoes were licensed to score scenes of longing, loss, and inner transformation. Yet still, few mainstream outlets bothered to tell his story. Pablo wasn't forgotten. He was overlooked, because his genius wasn't loud. The message beneath the melodica. Pablo's work was always more than sonic experimentation. It was a world view. He saw sound as healing. He saw rhythm as resistance. He saw each dub as a sermon, stripped down, purified, elemental. In East of the River Nile, you don't just hear a beat. You hear a river, ancient and spiritual, carrying generations of struggle and redemption. In King Tubby Meets Rockers Uptown, you don't just hear a studio session. You hear the collision of science and faith, of digital delay and ancestral memory. He made the melodica, a toy, into a symbol of dignity and defiance. And maybe that was the point all along. In a world obsessed with power and volume, Pablo chose softness. In a country torn apart by violence, he offered serenity. In an industry that rewards spectacle, he gave silence and space. His legacy, then, is not just in what he played, but in what he refused to play. He didn't sell out. He didn't water down his message. He didn't compromise. What remains today, Pablo is everywhere and nowhere. His face doesn't appear on reggae billboards or postage stamps. There are no Hollywood biopics. But his fingerprints are on every sound wave that values truth over trend, meditation over monetization, soul over spectacle. If Bob Marley was reggae's voice and Lee Scratch Perry was its wild mind, then Augustus Pablo was its spirit. You don't hear Pablo's legacy. You feel it. You feel it in the pause between notes. You feel it in the echo that trails off into nothing. You feel it when you close your eyes and the music doesn't entertain you. It awakens you. And maybe that's why the industry never knew what to do with him, because Augustus Pablo wasn't playing music. He was praying through it. Final reflection. So why is it that someone so foundational remains in the shadows? Why does the world still reduce his brilliance to a novelty instrument or a subgenre footnote? Is it because he didn't fit the mold of the revolutionary, or because the revolution he led was internal? Augustus Pablo showed us that dub wasn't just a remix style. It was a spiritual strategy, a cultural meditation, a rebellion in slow motion. His sound was a mirror held up to Babylon, showing that power didn't always come with fire. Sometimes it came with breath. The question now isn't just what Pablo left behind. The real question is, are we still listening?